How you doing? My name is John Troche. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John. Hi, John.
It's an honor and a privilege to be here. I want to thank Dave for asking me. You know, we have a lot to talk about. You know, there's a lot in this book. And I really would like to kind of, I know that there are some people in here that are more experienced with this book, but I understand that there are some newer people in here as well. So there's some things that I just kind of want to give some background information about what we're doing here, what this is about, what this book is about. And for anybody that doesn't know, this is a book that was written by a group of people. They started writing it in 1937. It was published in 1939. And what they did was, these were like a group of people that had, through the an organization that was around back in those days called the Oxford Group, they had started practicing certain spiritual principles as a possible means of recovering from alcoholism. And after a couple years of doing this, they looked around and they noticed, wow, there's about 40, 50 of us staying sober doing what we're doing, which is pretty amazing considering, you know, alcoholics are really, we don't really recover, you know. This is not like a rash. It's not going to clear up in like a weekend. Like this is, if you got it, usually you're going to die with it, you know. And they were doing this thing where they're like, they're part of a fellowship. The Oxford Group, you have to understand, was a spiritual organization. It was Christian. They were like practicing first century Christianity the way they believed the early Christians were practicing that. And these guys were doing this deal. And they were staying sober. They were not having to have a drink. And they were like happy, joyous, and free. They were like living, like they were free people. So when they took a look and they realized how many people were staying sober doing what they were doing, the long story short, what they decided to do was, let's get this down in black and white. Because as many of you know, the game telephone is I tell you, you tell her, she tells him, he tells her. By the time it gets down the hallway, it's a totally different message. And so part of what they wanted to do was have this codified in a place in black and white where it wouldn't get garbled. And that's why this book is so important to a lot of us, because this is where the original message was placed. And it wasn't just one author. It was, you know, a group of people putting their input into what should be in here. And so the way they laid this book out is they laid it out problem, solution, and then the plan, program of action, right? And in this book, he talks about the description of the alcoholic. They give a description of alcoholism in here. And so for me, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know what it really meant to be. I was having the experience of an alcoholic, not knowing what that really meant. If you would have asked me, you know, back in those days, are you an alcoholic? Maybe. You know, yeah, sure, okay, I'm an alcoholic. You know, like, I have a lot of repercussions, my life is a mess, I drink a lot, you know. So yeah, sure, okay, I'm at least that. But I had no idea what that really meant, to be an alcoholic. And most of us come in here like that. We don't really know what it means to be an alcoholic, even though we're living the experience of it. And so they put it down in black and white, like what this really means, and they laid it out. My experience was I had gotten a sponsor, and he started taking me through the book. And his attitude was the attitude that I try to have today when I take people through this book. And the attitude is this: I'm not here to tell you that you're an alcoholic. Honestly, really, it's not up to me. I'm here to try and help you find out what your truth is. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. Maybe you ended up in here by accident, right? Maybe you had a bad weekend. Maybe I'm willing to believe it's possible. You know, they lay it out in here, what's the difference between a real alcoholic and a hard drinker? And there's a difference. Maybe you're a hard drinker. And this is the place and the time to find out if you are, if you're a hard drinker. Because that might be the best news you'll ever get in your life, that you actually turn out to be a hard drinker. And you can just choose not to drink. And guess what? Good news about that, you can do that from the comfort of your own home. You don't even have to come here to do it. Right? So that might be the best news you ever get. But that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to help you to find out if you are or are not. And that's what my sponsor did for me. We met every week. We went through this book. And he made this come alive. I know my experience with, you know, he'd say, you know, read this, and I'd read it, and when I'd be reading it by myself, it'd be like, it would just go in one ear out the other. You know, it was like my mind was Swiss cheese. I get from, I turned the page and I couldn't even remember what was on the page before. It just was meaningless. But when we would get together and then go over what I had read, it was like he would, it would come alive. Mm-hmm. The way he spoke about this, it was like, wow, like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's real. It's really important, the work that we do with each other. So I'm going to, you know, I'm mainly going to concentrate on step one. There's a lot in this book about step one. And I'm basically going to talk about my experience as it pertains to this book. You know, the way they laid it out, first step, he lays it out as a threefold illness, physically, mentally, and spiritually. Right? I'm sick in three different ways. And the first one they lay out in this book is this physical component to alcoholism. You know, there's a chapter, it's really two letters from a doctor, Dr. Silkworth, at the beginning of the book, before chapter one. And Dr. Silkworth had come up with this theory, this opinion. And it was based on his work with thousands of alcoholics. He would work with these people, and he noticed that there was a certain person, a certain type of person, that would come in and out of his unit, in and out of his hospital. He worked at Towns Hospital in New York City. And to him, he saw these people as like, it just seemed like no matter what you did for this person, no matter how clear you were about what was happening, no matter how much you cared about them, no matter how many supports they had from their family, it didn't matter. They seemed to be hopeless, right? It was a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that these people were suffering from. But see, most people back in those days would agree, alcoholism, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you're just a degenerate. You know, yeah, you got mental problems and you're just a degenerate. But he saw something else. He saw this, there was a physical component to alcoholism. He saw that these people, certain people, that when they drank, something happened to them in their body, and it wasn't just their mind. That it would trip off this need for more. And if you're an alcoholic, you know about more, right? Mm-hmm. This is all about more, man. You know, I had no idea like that. Like I was, he says in here, you know, we don't like to think that we're bodily and mentally different from other people. I didn't want to think I was bodily and mentally different from other. I want to be like, you know, I want to be like everybody else. I want to be better than everybody else, but I want to be, you know what I mean? Like that's my MO. You know, like I want us to be good and we're all the same, but I want to be above you. You know what I mean? And I want you to be clear about that. I'm above you. You know what I mean? And that never worked out for me, by the way. So we'll go to page, in the doctor's opinion, XXVIII, because it's one of the seminal pieces of, you know, as they're laying out the case for alcoholism. And he writes at the last paragraph, he says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And after they've succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over and over and over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Now, this paragraph right here is like, there is so much in here. You know, this hits so many different points. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't know that coming in. I mean, not really. But when my sponsor broke that down for me, like, he talked about alcohol was the solution. And I've heard this, you know, thousands of times in the rooms of AA. Alcohol was my solution. And what I had to look at was the first time I got drunk. The first time I got drunk, I don't know, maybe 13 years old, and there's going to be a softball game. And I knew like days ahead, I knew it was going to be a softball game. It was summertime. Nobody was going to be home, and I came up with a plan. And my plan was, I'm going to go into my mother's liquor cabinet, and I'm going to take whatever's in there, and I'm going to take it with me, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to go to the softball game. Now, before I go to the softball game, I have this anxiety, right? I don't know why. I can't. At that point, I'm a little kid. I can't tell you why I feel the way I feel. You know, I just can't even see that. I know why now. You know, I know why I had that anxiety now, but I didn't know then. And as I'm walking to the softball field with what turned out to be gin, that's what I took, and I'm taking pops off it, before I'm halfway there, I'm not walking anymore. I'm floating, right? Something happened to me. Now, when I get to the softball field, I knew part of the reason I was anxious was there were going to be some older kids there, and part of that deal about, like, are they going to accept me? Are they going to like me? Am I going to be okay? Is it going to be all right? Blah, 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 all that stuff. That chatter that was in my head that I couldn't pinpoint, it was gone by the time I got to that field. When I got to that field, you know what my reaction was? I'm here. You guys are lucky that I'm here, right? That's how I felt. I felt like, you guys are lucky that I'm here. I am the party. The party is here. Mm-hmm. See, all the anxiety was gone. And guess what? I'll tell you this. I got so drunk that day and hanging out with all my new best friends. I mean, it was incredible, right? It was an incredible feeling. Now, once when I think about this memory, do I ever remember playing softball? I don't even know if we ever even had a game. You know what I mean? That's not part of the memory. When that day was done and I made my way back home, I was deathly ill. By the time I got home, my mom is now home. I get in. I try to evade. She catches me. I get sick. I get yelled at. I get in trouble. I get grounded on that. This is repercussions on my first drunk. From the very beginning, there's repercussions. And what I think about is the next day. The next day, I'm going over the events in my head about how everything happened. And as I'm going through these events, all I can think about is how it made me feel. Like what it did for me. Like I was like the man. I was so cool. I was like it, man. You know, that I was it. Now everything else that happened, the getting in trouble and the getting sick, that was a small price to pay for what I'd found. I found something. Now, when this happened, I didn't say to myself, oh, I found the solution to my life. I didn't say that. But what I did say was, I want to do that as much as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And that's code for, I found the solution to my life. Mm-hmm. Because that thing that alcohol did for me, that's what grabbed me. That's what had me. That's what, I would pursue that into the gates of insanity and death. That feeling, what it did for me. And I'll tell you this, that it doesn't do that for non-alcoholics. You know, I know people that they like to drink or so they're social drinkers. They don't have that kind of relationship that I had with alcohol, and that was from day one. That's where that came up. So when he says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, hell yeah, that's the effect I like. Now years later, when I'm at the end, like I mean, my life is hell. I remember I was coming in and out of AA meetings, right? And I was like doing the thing. I was doing this thing where I knew I had to be back here. Because I'd been sober before, and I knew that AA worked, but I was now in this horrible relapse that was going on for a long time. And I knew I had to come back, and I'm dipping my toe in the water, trying to get myself used to coming back to AA meetings, but I can't stop drinking. So maybe I'll drink before I come to the meeting, or sometimes I'll hold it together till the meeting starts, and then after the meeting I'll go, you know. Or, you know, maybe I'll go, you know what, I'm not going to drink tonight, I'll just do a little heroin, you know. Like, I'm gonna really be, like, do the right thing, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just, like, I'm insane, you know what I mean? Like, I go, yeah, I'm doing really good, I didn't drink in 3 days, I've been doing heroin, but I haven't drank in 3 days. And then I go, well, wait, isn't that kind of, let me do it the other way, let me drink and then I won't do the heroin, you know, and my mind is a mess. I remember this girl looks at me and she goes, why do you keep coming here, you know? And I looked at her and I said, because I want to stop, right? I want to stop, you know, and kind of being a smart ass a little bit, but there was a lot of truth in that. And then I remember having a conversation with another girl, and I remember going, you know, the thing of it is like, I love the way it makes me feel. I just hate what it's doing to my life, you know? And it was the most honest thing that I could say. I love the effect produced by alcohol. I love it. I love getting out of myself. I love being dead for like 10 hours a day. Like, I drink for oblivion. You know, I'm a coward. I don't want to kill myself. I mean, I do want to kill myself, but I don't want to kill myself. You know what I mean? So, like, I like drinking, like, I'm dead for 10 hours a day, and then I get to be alive again. Right. You know? And it's like this total coward's existence. That's me. You know, so did I like the effect produced? Yeah. Sure, I drink for effect. He says, the sensation is so elusive, while they admit it's injurious, they can't after time differentiate the true from the false. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing repercussions in my... I told you, from the first time I drank, there were repercussions. And the repercussions in my life got worse and worse and worse. They talk about progression in this book. And they progressively got worse. And I can see... So, my illness, the way it looks like in my life, is like, it's like... I see it. I don't see it. Oh, no, I see it. I see it. Oh, I lost it. I don't see it. See, like, I intermittently can see... This is bad. This is really getting bad. Like, my life is really getting bad, and then it's, you know, I don't know. It's not that bad, right? See, I can't differentiate the true from the false. I can't really see the reality of my situation. I get hints of it, and so I can admit that it's injurious, but after a time, I can't differentiate the true from the false. They talk about in this book this thing called delusion. Mm-hmm. And the way it was explained to me in the very beginning is, with my sponsor, and you know, we would listen to the Joe and Charlie tapes a lot, and they talked about delusion is believing a lie. I believe something that isn't true, and that's and think about all of the, and this is some of the exercises that we did. Let's look at some of the delusions that we have. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Bull, right? Nobody cares about me. Bull, right? It's my problem. See, if people would just leave me alone, I'd be okay. Right? If you guys would just get off my back, if you would just stop, I'd be all right. But it's you guys are doing this to me. Delusions. But I believe them. I believe this stuff. Right? So this is the hole that I find myself in. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I remember at one point, my home group is Pathway to Power, which is in Yonkers, New York. And when Dave asked me what the topic of this 7 or 8 weeks, whatever I'm doing here, what's it going to be? My thought was it's going to be Pathway to Power, and what that means to me is this first step is all about I find that I am powerless. I find that I am powerless, and I am effed. I am screwed. Right, it's like I'm up the creek without a paddle. I am doomed, as doomed can be. And my solution is not me fixing my life. My solution is getting access to power. If lack of power is my dilemma, I need to get access to power. I need to be able to plug into power. And part of the reason I have a problem plugging into power is like all this stuff in my head that blocks me from actually even seeing that it's possible. And that this whole process is about going from being a powerless individual whose life is unmanageable, going through this process so that you can get plugged into a power that can empower your life. And you can live the kind of life you never thought you could live. And that's been my experience. So this thing right here where it says, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I live in the Bronx. At this time, I lived in this apartment building up in the 20s. And it was beautiful, nice place. And I didn't live there because I deserved to be there. I was in a relationship with a woman, and her father had bought that apartment because he was like, I can't have my grandkid living in a shithole. Mm-hmm. So he basically bought that apartment, and us two, you know, maniacs live in it, in this nice place. So this place has like this complex, and there's like a pool. I mean, it's gorgeous. We have no right living there. We don't belong there. We don't have any right being there, yet we're there. And I remember it's summertime. And she has to take the kid down to the pool, right? And I'm like, I'm not going down to the pool. There's no way. You can't pay me to go down to the pool. Now, it's a beautiful day. There's a pool. Sky's blue. Beautiful puffy clouds in the sky, right? And all the lovely people are hanging out at the pool. And she's like, you got to come with me to the pool. And I go down with her to the pool. Actually, you know, I would try it sometimes because it would just, the complaining would just get to be too much. That is fine, I'll go. And we go down to the pool, and I'm sitting there. Now, here's all these, like, normal people living normal lives. They're like families, and, you know, and I'm hearing, like, bits and pieces of their conversations. And they're talking about their 401ks, and they're talking about summer camp, and they're talking about when school starts in September, and where is little Jimmy and little Johnny going. And I would sit there, and the anger, I would get so angry, right? And I'd be like, this is bullshit. Like, I couldn't take it, right? Now, and I would listen to this stuff, and I would be, I would last maybe 20 minutes. And I'd finally be, I gotta go. I gotta get out of here. I gotta go. Because I couldn't stand what was happening. See, like, these normal lives that these people were living in, they were good lives. To me, it was like an affront. Don't you realize what's happening? Don't you see the world that we're living in? Don't you understand what's going on? See, the insanity is all up in my head. And that's the way I perceive the world. My alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. That stuff, what they're talking about, is nonsense. I'm not gonna entertain this for a minute. And I would leave, I would storm upstairs, go back into the, pull down all the shades, get it real dark. I don't want that nice summer atmosphere coming in here. You know, right? Keep it out. And then I would wait till the sun would set. Once the sun would set and it was dark, now I can go out. Now I can be out there in the world. I'm like a vampire. I'm like a creature of the night. That's what I've become. That's what alcoholism looks like in my life as we progress further down the road. Right? So my alcoholic life seems the only normal. Yes. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes comes at once by taking a few drinks. I'm restless, irritable, discontent. I mean, I can't tell you how angry I am. I cannot express to you the level of discomfort that's going on inside of me on a daily basis. And I need alcohol and other substances to take me out of that. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm easily annoyed. I'm never satisfied. Things get under my skin. What it looks like for me is like I walk into a room and two people are having a conversation. And it has nothing to do with me at all. But I'm very angry about what they're talking about. Like, I hear like snippets of it, and it makes me angry. Are you kidding? That's your opinion? Did that just come out of your mouth? Now, this is all going on in my head. I'm not saying it to you, right? But in my mind, I'm thinking, like, you should die. I really hope you die. I really hope you die. Now, you're having a conversation that has nothing to do with me. But that's my reaction. That's my reaction on a regular basis. If you don't agree with me, you should die. That's how I feel. Right? I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm easily annoyed. I'm never satisfied. Things bother me that should not bother me, that have nothing to do with me. But I make it about me. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why I'm so uncomfortable. Now, alcohol used to work on that very, very well. It used to work beautifully on that. And other substances as well. I mean, I'll be honest. But what happened is, and I remember for... first time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was 1993. I was 19 at that time, and I belonged here then, right? And my first sponsor would say, he would talk about alcohol didn't work anymore. And I didn't get it. I'm like, I wouldn't say to him, like, well, what do you mean it doesn't work anymore? Because, see, like, I also have that thing where I need to know everything, right? So if I don't know something, I'll just keep my mouth shut until I figure it out. Right, which is like a really big mistake for a lot of us, because I had to unlearn so much bad information in my life that I figured out with my alcoholic mind, right? Instead of just asking the question, right? So he would say, "Alcohol stopped working," and I would sit there and I'd go, "I have no. What does he mean by that? Alcohol worked? I still got drunk. You know what I mean? I still got drunk till the very last time I got drunk. Of course, alcohol worked. What does he mean?" Later, I would find out what he was talking about. And what he was talking about is that alcohol used to work for restless, irritable, and discontent very, very well. And the worst thing that happens to us is when we get to the place where it no longer works. Where I am drunk as drunk can be, and I can still hear that stuff in my head, and it's driving me crazy. And I still have that feeling in my gut, and I want to kill, I want to die, I hate everything. And the alcohol's not taking that away. That is a horrible place to be. So where do I find myself? I find myself at the end of my last relapse. By the way, my sobriety date is January 1st, 2007. So 2006, somewhere in 2006. I'm living in that apartment that I was telling you about. I like to watch the Science Channel, and I love the Science Channel. And they would have on the Science Channel these shows where they would depict what they called extinction-level events, right? So, like, when the asteroid came and it hit the Earth and it wiped out the dinosaurs, right? Now, I would watch that, and I would go, that could happen? Now, when I say that, like, it was like with excitement, like, that could happen? Like, all of a sudden, this new possibility opened up for me. We could all get killed. We could all be wiped out together as a collective. And I would watch shows like when a show like that would come on. I was there like I'm sitting there and I actually feel good for like 30 seconds in my day, you know, and I'm excited about that. And I'm thinking like, now here's the thing. Now, and this is what was going on in my life. I would get in the elevator to go wherever I'm going to go, and I'd get in, and the thought would come. Wouldn't it be great if the cable would just collapse, would just snap, and I'd go plummeting to the ground and be dead? That would be awesome. That would be so great. Or I'd be driving my car and I would think, wouldn't it be great if somebody just went out of control and just hit me head on and just took me out? That would be fantastic. See, like, I'm having like suicidal ideation. I'm not, again, I told you, I'm not going to do it to myself, right? Because I'm a coward. And also for full disclosure, part of the reason I'm afraid to do it is I still have this fear that, well, what if there is a guy on the other side and then I have to answer for everything in my life and then he's going to yell at me because I committed suicide. Because I knew from a kid that was a big no-no. I was brought up Catholic. That's a no-no. You don't do that. So if something were to happen to me, it would be plausible deniability. You know, like I didn't actually do it to myself. That's what I'm kind of hoping for, right? So these are the thoughts that are going through my mind as I start to discover this new option of like, you mean we could do this on a worldwide level? Like everybody, we could all die at the same time. And I remember the fantasy was that if that happened, right? And everything was dead, and everything was destroyed, and there was nothing. And I don't want an afterlife. Mm-hmm. My feeling is that then I can finally be at peace and be left alone. And I'll tell you this, when I look back at that, and I think about that, I was willing to make that trade-off, like, you know, you can all die. I'm serious, you can all die. As long as I can get relief, I'm cool with that. And when they say selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our trouble. And I started to see, oh my God, the level of my selfishness is incredible. The level of my selfishness is incredible. And so I want to kind of fast forward to, there's this part in one of the best things that they write about the first step is in A Vision for You. And in A Vision for You, at the very beginning, page 151, he says, for most folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It's joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good, but not with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. And momentarily we did, and then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. I mean, do you understand that, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the deal, man. Like, going through this book and taking a look at what they're talking about, the description of alcoholism. Were you an unhappy drinker? Did you know terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair? Right? To understand what that is, to understand when you get to the place where the drink is not doing for you what it used to do for you. It won't take that away. They describe it in the book as being the jumping off place. Right? I can't imagine life with or without the drink. Right? And that's where I found myself, at that place where I could not imagine my life with it or without it. And the heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would fix it. That there's some way that I can enjoy and control my drinking. It's my obsession. I find myself in that place that I'm describing to you in 2006. And I really want to kind of hit on... Let me just back up for 1 second before I talk about that. Just to finish up on this physical part of this illness. They describe in this book that if you're a real alcoholic, right, what happens is you take a drink and it triggers something in your body that the next drink has to happen. It's going to happen, right? I had the experience, they describe in this book the moderate drinker, the heavy drinker, and the real alcoholic. And let's see if we want to hit on that. Right here. Okay. So he says on page 20, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. If they have a good reason for it, they can take it or leave it alone. Never my experience. And I never mingled with people like that at all. Like, for a long time I read that and it's like some mythical creature they're talking about. Until my wife. She wasn't my wife at this point. You know, we're dating at this point. My wife turns out to be the moderate temperate drinker. And one day she's having a glass of wine. She has her glass of wine. I'm watching this. You know, I'm like, oh, cool. Okay. So I'm watching it. She has her one glass. She pours her second glass, and she drinks half of her second glass, and then it just sits there. And I'm like... And I'm watching this, you know, like I'm aware of myself watching what she's doing. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen next, you know. And, you know, some time goes by and I go, what's up? Are you going to finish that? You know, like, what's up? And she's like, you know. I go, what do you mean, nah? She goes, you know, I don't really feel like it. I go, what? I go, let me ask you this. How much do you drink? And she goes... The most I would drink is maybe finish that, but I would never drink a third. And I go, well, why not? Have you ever tried to drink a third? And she goes, well, if I did, what would happen for me is I'd either fall asleep or I'd get sick. And I don't want either one of those things to happen, so I don't have a third. And my mind was just blown wide open. Like, oh my God, this is what they were talking about. See, like her reaction to alcohol is completely different than my reaction to alcohol. That's her reaction. She has one and a half, maybe two drinks, and that's it. She never wants more. She doesn't want any more. My reaction to alcohol is I have one or two, and something happens to me that doesn't happen in her, where I go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's go. And see, the thing is like when it's happening, I don't say to myself, there's the physical craving. Here it comes. See, it doesn't look that way to me. What it looks like to me is even if I said to myself, I shouldn't get drunk tonight, and I'm not going to get drunk tonight, I should only just have a little bit. I have those one or two, and that thing happens. It seems to me like my mind, I just changed my mind. Like I said, you know what? Today's actually a really great day to get drunk. You know, like, I'm not going to get that drunk. I'm just going to have a few more. See, it always seemed like I was making this choice. And what they talk about in this book is that if you're an alcoholic, you've lost power, choice, and control. And that was confusing to me because it seemed like I was making a choice. And it seems to a lot of people that I work with that they're making a choice too. That they're making this decision to continue drinking. And I had to start seeing that what seemed like a decision was not a decision. It was an inevitability. It's what Dr. Bob realizes when he has the conversation with Bill. You know, he never took into account that he could not moderate his drinking. And that's what they talk about in this book, moderation. I've never been able to moderate. Not my experience. So that's basically this physical part of this illness. And they talk about this illness as, well, if you have that, I mean, chances are you're an alcoholic. Because it really doesn't happen in moderate temperate drinkers. If you have that experience even once, that takes you out of the category of being a moderate temperate drinker. Then they talk about this other person. They say, then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally, and it may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. So now, think about this. Now we have another type of person. And I'll tell you this, I've hung out with lots of people like that. Hard drinkers. That they were like running partners. They were buddies. They drank like me. They acted like me. They seemed like they were just like me. Right? But if you gave them a good enough reason to stop and stay stop, they could do it. And I couldn't. And I couldn't wrap my mind around that. Right? And that's the question that you have to ask yourself. Have you had good reasons to stop your drinking? Have you been presented with good reasons why you should never drink again? Here's a good example. Your significant other says, I love you. I'm crazy about you. I'd love to spend the rest of my life with you, but your drinking is horrific. And if you don't stop, we're done. We're done. Now, that's a good reason to stop. That's a damn good reason to stop, especially if you love your significant other. Now ask yourself the question, have you been in that position? Mm. What happened when they gave you that ultimatum? I'll tell you what happened for me. I said, see ya. Mm. Don't ever give me an ultimatum. I don't care. You're gonna come at me like that? You're gonna try and take the one thing that makes my life make sense? You're gonna try and take that away from me? Bye. Some people might say, you know what? I love you so much. You're right. I gotta stop. But ask yourself what happened a day later, a week later, a month later. Were you able to stay stop? The employer says, you're a great worker, I love you, but you know what? You keep it up, you got to go. Were you able to stop? Doctor says, if you don't stop doing what you're doing, you're going to have some serious health problems. Were you able to stop and stay stop? See, this is really simple stuff. All you have to do is look at your own experience. Is that how it came out? Now, if it turns out you're a person who had good reasons to stop, and maybe even you wanted to stop because of those good reasons, and yet you were unable to stop, what they're suggesting in this book is that you might be beyond human aid. Right? Human aid is like, I'll do it for her. I'll do it for the kids. I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I'm going to make a decision and I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a good guy. Like, that's all human aid. And you might be beyond that. And that's the next thing that we had to start looking at is, am I beyond human aid? Can I pull it together or not? So now the next thing I want to talk about is this insanity thing. They talk about, we're insane. And they talk about in here, self-knowledge availed us nothing. I had a lot of knowledge about this illness, about myself. And so it's back in 2006. And I told you, all this stuff about where I was at as far as like emotionally. I was, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Four horsemen, for sure. All the time. I mean, my life was not going well. If somebody were to come up to me and have a button, and they said, all you have to do is press this button and you'll disappear forever. You wouldn't even finish that sentence. I would have pressed that button. I was so checked out of life. I couldn't wait for this thing to be over. I was done. That's how I felt. I wanted to be dead. And here's the kicker. I want to be dead. And I keep waking up. Right? And I already told you, I'm too much of a coward to do it to myself. So I'm like in this trap that I can't spring. I'm totally out of my mind. I'm just like, I need something. I need help. I need some kind of relief. Anything. I'm in pain. Deep emotional pain. And and then this is this is what happens. I start saying to myself, you know what? You got to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it, man. That's it. You got to go back to AA. See, like the first time I came into AA in 1993, I ended up being sober for 7 years before I eventually relapsed. Right? When I picked up that first drink, I did that 100% sober. Right? That's the insanity. Right? I had another time when I was sober for 3 years in AA and relapsed. Insanity. Okay? I had the experience of being in AA, gone through this book. I understood this book. I understood my illness. Right? And my experience was the only time my life had ever really worked, it really made sense and I was comfortable in my own skin, I was happy, joyous, and free, was in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my experience. So now here I am in this place, the Four Horsemen are all around me, and I go, I got to go back to AA. That's what I got to do. I have to go. And I talk to myself, right? So I'm sitting there and I go, okay, you know what your problem is, right? Your problem is that it's threefold in nature, physical, mental, spiritual. You know that. It's clear. Look at it. I could see it. I knew what my solution was, right? The solution was spiritual in nature. This book talks about the answer being a spiritual answer. And I knew where to find the answer in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that. I knew I had to come back here and get a sponsor and start going through the steps. And I knew all of that. I knew it. Clearly, I knew it. And this is the insanity. My mind goes, John, you're right. You got to go back to AA. And you're going to go back to AA. But there's one problem. And that problem is that my friend Joe, who had been traveling around the world for the last year and a half, he was coming back to New York in December. And Joe was going to be so disappointed if when he came back, I was in AA, right? Like, he'll be so disappointed if that's the case, right? So my brilliant mind says, so here's the deal. You're going to go back to AA, yeah. But think about this. Joe will come back in December. You guys, you can recapture the good old days. It's kind of like when Ebby went to see Bill and Bill wanted to recapture the good old days and he's thinking about the airplane that they chartered and all that crazy stuff that they did. He's thinking about that stuff and that's like some gas for about 5 seconds to make him feel good. You know, and that's kind of like where my mind's at. And I'm like, okay, so Joe comes back and you hang out. Do the deal, man. And you know when you can go back to AA? Now this is my brilliant mind, right? My brilliant mind says, you can go back to AA on January 1st of 2007. And you want to know why? Because that's the first day of a new year. And it's a clean slate. Think how great that will be. Now, I'm sitting in my living room like a lunatic going, yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. That's good. Yeah, that's good. I like that. I like that a lot. Now, I already told you, I went through the whole thing in my head about, I know what the problem is, I know what the solution is, I know where to find the solution, I know this. But this is an illness that defies your intellect. It defies rationality. In the face of, like, total destruction, my insanity is, but Joe would be so disappointed if when he comes back, you're sober. So, like, it's insane. And then, you know, to really, like, seal the deal. My mind goes, Nan, think about it. You can take this month to get done. Oh. Yeah? Now, do you know, you guys know about getting done? Mm-hmm. It's a really important thing to get done. Mm-hmm. If you're not done yet, you need to get done. There's no substitution for getting done. And in my mind, I go, this is going to be perfect. I'm going to get done. I'll get done. And so December starts, and I'm a man on a mission. I'm on a mission to get done. And I'm getting done, man. I am, like, doing the deal. And the month is flying by. You know, it's like, day, night, day, night, day, night, day, night. And I'm like, I can't stop. You know, I'm just like a maniac, you know. Mm-hmm. And Joe's back, and I'm desperately trying to capture the good old days, you know. And now I'm getting closer to January 1st. It's coming. And I'm being reminded, like, oh yeah, remember that thing that you said you were going to do January 1st? Like, it's coming, you know? And the fear is like, it just grips me. Because the truth is, I don't have an off switch, you know? Like, I've never been able to call my date and be like, oh, that's the day I'm going to get. So I've never been able to do that, you know? So it's not like I was like, I was under any illusions that I could do it. It was just kind of like, I think that'd be a good idea, January 1st. Now I'm like, I'm not so sure that's such a great idea, you know? And but, you know, I do want to come back because I do want relief because I'm dying. And I know I'm dying, right? So we get to New Year's Eve. And I had a couple, because of my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had some sober friends who had been worried about me. You know, they saw what was going on with me. And they said, they got me to promise them that I would go with them to the sober dance somewhere in like Greenwich Village somewhere, you know. And I didn't want to go at all, but they really pressed me. And, you know, I'm a man of my word. Yeah, right. I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll go. All right. And they got me to say yes. And now I'm really annoyed that I got to go to this thing. And it's my last night. So they get me and we go there. And I'm like a madman. I'm just like just not happy. I'm just like so out of it too. And we get to this dance, and we're there about a half hour before they stop paying attention to me, and they're kind of doing their own thing. And that's the perfect opportunity to go out a side door and slip them. And that's what I did. And I go and I meet with my ex girlfriend. And this is my last night. This is the last hurrah. We're going to get done. And so me and her head back to the apartment that I used to live in with her on the 20th floor. And we're getting done, you know? And we're getting done. And we're having this conversation. And in my head, the whole time I'm thinking, tomorrow's going to be the day. And there's the emotional reaction of, I have no idea I'm going to be able to go back. Right? We're having this conversation. Getting done. And we're reminded of this event that happened in our lives, right, with us, where I went to open up a window like a year and a half earlier, and I went flying backwards. I smashed my head on the hardwood floor, and I basically was like incoherent for the whole night. I was shaking. It was crazy, you know. Like I just couldn't put two thoughts together. And we're talking about that, and I say to her, I go, how did you know not to call 911 when that happened? Because it was a really scary experience. And she said, she goes, well, I was afraid if I did that, we'd get in trouble. And I go, you're right. That's good thinking. Don't ever call 911. Literally, that's what comes out of my mouth. Don't ever call. That was good thinking. Don't ever call 911. And about 30 seconds later, IOD. Now it happened so fast after I said that, she actually, this is her reporting this to me because I wasn't there for this part. She said, I thought you were joking because you'd said that and then the next thing you're like, you know, out of it. And I told you stop joking around. And I wasn't joking. The next thing I remember is there's EMTs and police officers and all kinds of first responders all around me. And they're finally getting me. They're resuscitating me, and they go, "Do you know what happened?" And I have, did I fall again? And basically, they let me know. They're like, "Listen, you swallowed your tongue. Your lips were blue. You were dead. You're lucky she called us." And I go, "Wait, I told her never to call them. Like, thank God she never listened to me. You know, one more example of her not listening to me. And that one was the one that really." Thank God she didn't. And they take me and they put me in this stretcher and they're taking me down to the ambulance. And I'm just like, I'm thinking like, I can't believe this just happened. You know, because here's the deal. I was going to go back to AA January 1st, 2007. You know, like I was clear about that. It was not like, and when I say that was my plan, like I'm saying that legit was my plan. Even though I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to do it, that was legit my plan. I am going to try. I'm going to go back to AA and get this sobriety thing back. And I'm going down in the stretcher, and I start thinking like, I remember so many times in the rooms of AA, I would hear this, and it would usually be from an old-timer, and they would say something like this. If I go out and drink tonight, there's no guarantee I'll come back because I might die. And I would always think, oh my God, you're so dramatic. Like, you're not going to die. You know, like, that was just like my gut reaction was just like, shut up. It's so dramatic. You know? And now, as they're bringing me down, I'm thinking, this is exactly what they were always talking about in the rooms of AA. See, like, I hated people that were trying to scare me straight. You know, my whole life was a series of people trying to scare me straight in my mind. Are you just trying to scare me? Shut the hell up, you know? And now I'm going into this ambulance. I'm like, my plan was to go to AA January 1st, and I never took into account New Year's Eve. I never did. And I had a whole new experience with the gut-level powerlessness of the first step, which is I think I know when this thing is going to kill me. I think I know. I think that the day that it's going to kill me, that there's going to be something I'm going to be able to do to save myself. Because on some level, I don't truly understand what it means to be powerless. I think I have a measure of control somewhere. I think I'm smart enough to see the signs and evade. And the reality is, the day this thing is going to kill me, and it's going to kill me, there's going to be nothing I can do to stop it. And I saw how many people must have died the same way I just almost died. Because they thought they had another. They thought they had tomorrow. See, I always thought, I have tomorrow. I have tomorrow. Tomorrow, tomorrow. I don't know I have tomorrow. That experience for me was like, after everything else that had happened, that was like the icing on the cake that solidified the first step experience where I saw the true nature of where I was and what I had. And where I was and what I have is, and they describe it in this book, they describe alcoholism as being progressive, incurable, and fatal. Mm. I had progressed. You know, I didn't start out, my drinking did not start out where it ended up. You know, that even though, no matter how bad I was as a kid, it still got worse. Incurable, listen, I had been sober for 7 years at one point. I had been sober for 3 years at another point. And guess what? I pick up a drink. The same thing that happened, that always used to happen to me, still happens to me. And if I pick up a drink 11 years after I've been sober for this amount of time, guess what? The same thing's going to happen because it's incurable. I'm never going to change my reaction to alcohol. It's just not going to happen. And fatal. This thing will kill me. And I saw that. It is going to kill me. So the first step experience, I need to have this. I need to get to this place where I see it. Man, I see it. There's no way I'm going to go through with the rest of the steps if I don't believe my life really depends on it. And that's where I got to. I got to the place where I really believe that my life depended on it. I'll give you two or three more really quick stories. So the insanity, I lay out the insanity. Here's another version of the insanity, right? I had been sober for 7 years, like I told you, right? And I was a member of the greatest group in AA. I mean, you couldn't even argue with me about that. It was the greatest group in AA, bar none. Okay? The only problem with being a member of the greatest group in AA is if you move, you have a real problem, right? And I had moved, and now I had a real problem. Because every group that I go to, I'm kind of like, you guys aren't doing it right. You know, like, you should be doing this, and you should do that. And whenever you go to a group and you tell them that they're not doing it right, they always, like, scowl at you. Like, nobody ever is like, yeah, you're right. You know, we should do it your way. It's just not my experience. So I eventually hook up with a group. Nothing wrong with that group, just not my original group, right? And things were a little bit more lax. And now I've got, at that point now, 5 years, 6 years. And I go, all right, you know what? I don't have to be a member of the greatest group anyway, because I kind of know everything there is to know about alcoholism and the big book and God and everything else. I think I'll be okay. I think I'll be all right. And what happened for me was this thing that happens to lots of people in the rooms of AA. It's called getting sick in the rooms of AA. It's called untreated alcoholism. See, here's this thing that I have that, like, I think that just being sober is going to treat this condition. Psh, big mistake. I thought that, well, the work that I had done in the past qualifies me to kind of just coast and be okay. Big mistake. So at 5 years, I start coasting, and I start, you know, that old saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I'm in this new group, and I'm doing as the Romans do. I'm like a fellowshipper now. I love it. I'm just a fellowshipping fool. I'll fellowship you to death. I mean, I'm just in, I'm like, you know, hey, man, you know what? This is how we roll. All right, let's roll this way. You know, fast forward 2 years. Now all of my fellowshipping had gotten me to the point where I was kind of in trouble with some people in AA. You know, like now I am like the source of, like, you know, water cooler gossip. You know, and I'm not really happy about that. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Screw those people, man. Like, you're going to judge me for the things that I do. Look at what you do, you son of a. You know, and like this is like the stuff that goes on in my mind. This is like part of this illness. Mm-hmm. You know, so now. We're not as cool as we were, you know? You know what? I'll keep you at arm's length. And you know what? By the way, my sponsor that I have, he's kind of like my sponsor in name only now, you know? We're kind of estranged. We don't really have, like, you know, deep, meaningful conversations about my alcoholism. We're kind of like, you know, And now, as this is happening, I start having these brilliant thoughts. They're a lot like that conversation I had with, you know, that I told you about in my living room. A lot of those conversations. This conversation went like this. It went, you know, John, when you came into AA, you were 19 years old. And you were drinking and using drugs. And you were, you know, you were not very responsible. And you know what? There's a lot of people, a lot of young people in the world that drink irresponsibly. You can go to any college campus and see it for yourself. That doesn't make them an alcoholic. Maybe you're not an alcoholic. Maybe you're what they describe in here as the hard drinker. Maybe if you just had a good enough reason to stop, you could stop. And maybe you did have a good enough reason to stop, and you've just been going to AA. Maybe you don't need to be in AA anymore. And I went, that's brilliant. I was like, that is so smart. I might not, you know what? Listen, I'm the man of consideration. I am. I've learned how to consider things in AA. Oh, this is, he's so clever, man. It is so clever. It uses everything. And it used that one. And I said, yeah, you know what? There's a good chance that I might not be an alcoholic. I might just be a heavy drinker. And you know what? There's only one way to find out. You know what I mean? There's only one way. And that could be fun, you know? And I remember this thing was going on in my feeble mind for a while. This thing about, I should test it. And then and I'm not talking to any of you good people about this. This is all in my head, which is like a bad place for me to be when I'm in untreated alcoholism. And then it went from I should to I'm gonna. Yeah, I am gonna. I'm gonna do it. Yeah. And you know what I can do is, see, when I came in when I was 19, I didn't know anything about the mental obsession, the physical craving. They taught me that. They taught me that when I came into AA. You know what? Maybe I just bought into the company lie, you know? Like, maybe I'm just one of those guys that, like, they told me and I accepted it, and maybe it's not true. I should find out, right? So the day comes after 7.5 years of sobriety where I pick up that drink. And I can tell you, I remember exactly where I was, down in the village, and I start drinking, and I remember the smile was like from ear to ear. And the feeling was, this feeling of relief. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I remember this. It was like being reunited with the love of my life. And I remember thinking, like, I should have did this years ago. What was I thinking? This is fantastic. This is exactly what I forgot about this. And now I remember. This is the thing, man. This is the deal. Now, I was going to, the thing that my plan was, I'll watch myself. I'll watch what happens. I'll really, you know what, I'm really going to find out if that stuff is true, you know, physical craving, mental obsession. I'm going to really study it like a scientist. Man, I didn't have to study it for a day, man. It was as soon as I start drinking, it was like instantly revealed to me. Oh my God, yeah. That's the deal. Once I start, I can't stop. That's my experience. I was with a girl that I was dating that night, the night that I relapsed, on a Friday night. The next time she calls me, it's a Wednesday. And I'll never forget this conversation. It's a Wednesday. I'm in my apartment. I'm watching a Yankee game. I'm drinking. She calls me up. She goes, hey, what are you doing? Ah, I'm just watching the Yankees, drinking some beers. She goes, oh, you're at a party? I go, no, I'm home. She goes, you're home by... She goes, you have people over? I go, no, I'm by myself. She goes, oh. I go, what's oh? You know, like, what are you talking about?
Wow.
She goes, I didn't know it was like that. And I go, you didn't know it was like what? She goes, you're home by yourself on a Wednesday drinking? And I'm like, yeah, like what, you know what? And I was really annoyed. I hung up on her. And it was like, that's just the way it is for me. Like, once I start, I can't stop. I just can't. So these are the things in my life that I had to be directed to, that I had to look at it to match it to what they're talking about in this book when they describe alcoholism. Because if you got it, this is not me trying to scare you straight. It's just reality. If you got it, it's going to kill you unless you get a solution to that problem. That's been my experience. And for anybody who's been here for a while, you know we see people die all the time, right? This is about life and death, and we see people die all the time. And I encourage anybody in here, if you're new, you're just coming back, if you have a sponsor or you don't have a sponsor, get somebody who's been through this book, somebody who could make this book come alive for you, you know, who can really talk about, this is what they're talking about here. Do you relate? It's a beautiful experience when you really have that come alive for yourself and you finally see the truth. And the truth may be you are an alcoholic, and the truth might be even better. You might find out you're not. And that would be a beautiful experience, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, listen, to each their own. But I want to thank you for letting me talk to you about the first step, and I guess we open it up at this point?
Yes.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.